Welcome. You're listening to the Mac Observer's Background Mode. This is your host, John Martellaro. And this week, my guest is the co-founder of Aquamind Software, Scott Love. Scott, good afternoon.
Hey, John. How are you?
Hey, I'm good. How about you?
Well, just hanging out here in Palo Alto, California.
Cool. It's a pleasure to have you on the show.
Well, thank you for having me.
You know, for the listeners out there, I must tell them that Scott and I have been friends for a long time, longer than I it's painless to remember.
Hey, we're almost as old as the apple.
Well, I take that as you wish. So we met each other back when you were first building this wonderful tool called Aquamind's Note Taker.
Correct.
Tell us how that came to be. I want to go back a little before that and tell me what you were doing before.
Oh, we can go way back.
Well, yeah, but you know, you and I have talked about a lot of stuff over the years, but just kind of bring us up to date, the listeners and me. I mean, what was leading up to, you know, the first co-founding of Aquamind's and Note Taker? What were you doing just before that?
Sure. Yeah. Great question. Well, so from a history standpoint, I think some of your listeners will appreciate it, because I think any of us who use personal computers have always wanted to have what I call thinking tools, or tools for augmenting, you know, our intelligence or amplifying it. And the genesis, the idea behind Note Taker, it's not a new one, but it's one that I think, you know, as we've gotten better and better at, especially searching and manipulating text and information on our computers, there's always been a need for storing it and keeping a personal notebook, and hopefully that notebook is a little more intelligent than just a scrapbook. And really behind the idea was many years of being part of other efforts, both at Apple. I also worked at Next Computer.
I did not know.
Yep. And in fact,
got to know Bud Tribble?
Well, I knew Bud from Mac days, but the real interesting thing, I think, for at least for my personal journey, at Next, you know, Steve had this tremendous vision for creating visual fidelity on the screen. And to do that, his vision was we would use Adobe Display PostScript. And Display PostScript would allow you to simply, in Steve's idea, was to TypeScript, you know, sort of put beautifully rendered text on the screen at the highest resolution possible at the time. And of course, it was expensive and it was gorgeous. And I think for those that first saw some of the first demos that Steve did of Next with Digital Librarian, he'd put up Shakespeare, he'd put up a New York Times page, and it would render at 400 dots per inch. So it was not probably as I think the quality was near typeset, which was what Steve was envisioning. But the beauty there was really having an experience, an immersive experience with text, if there could be such a
thing.
That
was part of his experience at Reed College, right? Where he was taking those typesetting classes.
Or calligraphy. He was, you know, I think he loved the art and the sort of the zen and aesthetic of it. But I think the theme of beautiful books being essentially rendered on the screen was a big part of Steve's passion for Next. And those of us that worked there and were lucky enough to work with some of the people at Next just had this incredible creativity towards this vision that Steve was building around the digital librarian. And about the same time, the internet was essentially getting, I wouldn't say commercialized, it was getting connected, right? And so you were seeing a lot of creative development, especially around university labs and CERN, obviously, where early, you know, Next users were beginning to see the value of having this rich media environment on the screen, even more so than what you had with your Mac. And as a result, as web pages were getting rendered and there was more information to manage, that became, and in fact, an issue for users, right? Because in the early days of the internet, there wasn't really an idea for keeping stuff around and storing it and then, you know, recalling it. And that was really the inspiration for doing the first product, which I did with Jason Adams. We actually did that at Millennium Software. And that product was called Notebook. And its big claim to fame as a Next user was to allow you to clip information from either your Next mail or to clip it from another application or your browser and then store that in your notebook and index it. And that really was the first crystallization of that idea. And I did that with Jason. And then a couple of companies later, after we had worked together at Netscape, we both kind of went our own ways. And as it would be, you know, Next was acquired by Apple. And Steve brought that same beautiful vision to the Mac. And as a result, I think the developer community, with Steve coming back to Apple, was really inspired to do great work. And obviously, I wanted to do a version of Notebook for Mac, which that became Notetaker. Now, it's a little different.
What year was that?
Well, that was 2002. And in fact, what's interesting, just as a factoid in the timeline, that was the first Mac OS X application in that particular category, which I would call sort of PIM on steroids. And the interesting thing
about Personal Information Manager.
Right. And the interesting thing about that, John, was we beat the competition, and that competition was Microsoft releasing OneNote on Windows about a year later. And then, you know, Jason had his version of Notebook for the Mac as well, which he called Notebook. That was the Circus Ponies product. Very fine product. And so what was really fun at the time was you had this just tremendous amount of creative force coming onto the Mac as a result of Steve returning to Apple. And, you know, I guess maybe we're sort of taking claim for things, but I really believe there was this great renaissance of software development that came back to Apple as a result of Steve kind of energizing Apple again, especially in the software community. And I think the early days of the new, what I call the kind of the new Mac platform, was just fantastic, right? There was just so much innovation going on.
Well, I want to ask you about that. So how would you compare the environment? We had this brand new, you know, Unix-based operating system. We had these cool tools that came over from Next. And the Macintosh was pretty much Apple's only product, although the iPod was announced, what, fall 2001. But how would you compare the development environment and the excitement in those days to today, 14 years later?
Well, I mean, for myself, being more, you know, I think, you know, having been through sort of the decade of each of the, what I call sort of the big waves of computing, you know, today is so focused on mobile and integration with the cloud and the user experience. You know, what users moving into this mobile world, I think the development is a lot different. And let's be clear, it's a much more competitive landscape because the value of individual software applications, you know, has kind of, I'd say in some ways, lost its leverage, at least from a business standpoint for individual developers. The creativity is still there, but it's much more difficult with so much competition and so many different titles to choose from that I think it's incredibly challenging business. But having said that, there's just a tremendous amount of you know, I guess you could call it stuff to be done, right? Great user experiences yet to be done. And I think that that will never stop. That will never cease, because the level of innovation that, you know, you see even right now, people are just kind of warming up to saying, okay, what can I do with voice that I haven't done before? And a great example of that, you know, Apple, you know, obviously Steve made that investment in Siri, but I think right now the most ascendant application in voice right now is probably Amazon's, you know, Echo, using Alexa persona for, you know, interfacing with their cloud services. And it's a really exciting platform. So I, you know, from that standpoint, a lot has changed from that direction. But again, back to the basic principles, you know, Steve didn't bring everything, all of the goodness we had at Next. And I'll give you one very interesting example. So object communications on Next was kind of the next big thing that, that Steve was a proponent of. And the idea there was that we could write, developers and Next could write fairly sophisticated components, collections of objects that could be reused over and over again. And part of that was to be able to communicate between objects that didn't know anything about each other. So a prime example might be today that you do a service and you clip something to another application or you call another application. But in the case of Steve's vision, the idea would be like you had a spreadsheet object that could, you know, reinstantiate itself inside your, you know, another application that didn't know anything about the spreadsheet, and the data would be live and updating itself. We didn't bring all that to Apple. And I think what we missed out on was kind of a richness that, you know, you would ideally like to have, but, you know, that's another challenging part of building a platform. You know, not everything is going to see the light of day.
Yeah, and Steve had his challenges with the hardware too. At the same time, there were all these performers, and the product portfolio was a mess. And Steve had to work with Johnny Ive on getting that glorious Bondi blue iMac out the door.
That's so right.
That was his first priority, to save the company and get people standing in line for hardware.
Yeah, absolutely. But I think to his credit too, he understood, he always had understood that a great platform was going to have an ecosystem of developers both on the hardware and on the software side. And now what we see is, you know, here we are in 2016, and it's this enormous ecosystem that includes movie makers, you know, recording artists, composers. So it's not just software and hardware geeks, right? It's a tremendously creative ecosystem that we live in now.
How did Aquaminds and Notetaker roll with the punches, so to speak, as we moved into mobile?
Well, I can honestly say that we had really focused on desktop power and serving. And so when iOS came along with iPhone and with iPad, we did do a viewer application, but we were really challenged both from a resource standpoint and from a technical standpoint. There was this big gap between what you could do on the desktop with rich text and then moving into iOS. There really wasn't an equivalent rich text environment. You had to sort of do all this translation to move strings around and manipulate. And I think that has always been a challenge for anybody who's working in you know, a rich text environment from the desktop side. So people had to make trade-offs. And I think we just probably spent way too much time trying to figure out how to either minimize the trade-offs or start over.
Interesting.
Right.
Interesting.
Right. And so some people took, in the early days, let's say, of OneNote showing up on iOS, Microsoft took the lowest common denominator. They basically just gave you sort of this poorly formatted HTML text, and you didn't get tables, and you didn't get... So there was a little bit of fidelity, you know, or impedance mismatch, because you'd have something that looked gorgeous on your Windows or your Mac desktop, but as soon as you wanted to see that same rendered beautiful page on your iPhone, iPad, gone, not there.
And I'm glad we dug into that, because that's something people don't talk about much. That's interesting.
Well, it's a challenge, right? And from a development standpoint, it is not a trivial problem. So I do think Apple recognized it. I think they probably kept a lot of the tricks of the trade to themselves as they were building their own applications portfolio with Pages and with some of their other applications. You know, so I don't know. You know, that crosses the line from sort of business considerations and politics and what large corporations decide to do.
Sure.
And it may have a real, you know, but on the other hand, you notice it didn't really prevent a lot of innovation from happening, right? People still went ahead and said, well, I'll come up with my own solution. But it's expensive. Development still is a very expensive, you know, if you want to take an example, doing an interactive game at the scale that people do, publishers, that's serious development money, right? That's hundreds of millions of dollars at stake in development. For a 1 to 2 person development house, you can't make too many mistakes, or, you know, that's really, there's not a lot of room for errors.
Well, I want to talk about this some more, but right now it's a very good time to take a break. Folks, stay with us. We'll be back in 60 seconds.
Hello there, all you fabulous Background Mode listeners. I'm Kelly Gamont with the Mac Observer, and I just want to say a few words about how you can support all the things we do. If you're thinking about buying something from Apple, Amazon, or Mac Mall, just go to the Mac Observer's homepage, where we have a section called Support TMO. Or you can just enter macobserver.com/Apple Store, all one word, and that will take you to our special page for Apple and our other affiliates. If you make a purchase from one of our partners this way, the Mac Observer receives a small compensation for sending business their direction. Pretty cool, right? And you don't pay a penny more. This small fee from our affiliates helps us continue to bring you TMO's daily news, reviews, tips, how-tos, and podcasts like this one. So the next time you're thinking about an online purchase, come to TMO's homepage and support the Mac Observer. Thanks. Back to you, John.
Okay, we're back. Scott, I wanted to kind of follow up with you on what we were talking about before the break, about how you feel about the Mac App Store and life as a developer in 2016, and the security provisions that Apple's introduced into OS X. Any thoughts?
Well, I think all those things, at least from the standpoint of the ecosystem and the store, were inevitable. I mean, I think that there's always a pain point between consumers and the products. And we kind of rolled with the punches and followed Apple's, you know, leadership into the market. And that meant also following their guidelines religiously, which, you know, I think for a lot of longtime, you know, Apple and Mac users, that carried along with it a lot of stress and, you know, its own pain points. An example would be that, you know, up until the App Store and Gatekeeper and this whole sort of managed garden of security around software vetting, that Mac had its own culture of modifying the system, right? Getting it the way you wanted it. And for a long, long time, there was a healthy industry built around plugins and individuals that could do cool things to modify menus and could add and extend the Mac in ways that you were never going to get from Apple itself. And it didn't really matter what the reason might be. It was just, here's a way in which the platform can get extended for individuals. And that was a very thriving, very important part of the Apple culture. So when the App Store started enforcing, and each release of the OS X started enforcing, you know, this whole sort of keeping everything controlled, it had a lot of value, right? Because consumers that were, let's say, now coming to the Mac as a consumer product expected that level of security. And
did you have to make some significant changes to the structure of NoteTaker?
Yes, we did. I'll give you a very two parts. One is philosophical, and one was technical. So, in a couple of the first generations of our development, we had a number of users in education where we had a very strong following, and we did very well in education for a long time, and we shadowed the success Apple was having with one-to-one laptop programs. We were one of the very first applications that was bundled in the main learning technology initiative, where every middle school student was going to have, you know, a Mac laptop. So we were bundled as part of that initiative, and those were four-year initiatives. And, you know, like everything else, you get to know your users, and the users come to you, and it might be a math teacher, it might be a history teacher, could be an English teacher, and they would have a request for, you know, some sort of extension or enhancement. Well, as we know, you can't, as a software developer, you make tough choices because you can't do every good idea. So some great ideas get left, you know, out of development cycles. And so you thought, well, is there something we could do that could at least give some of these users some choices? And so we implemented a plug-in architecture for Java applets. And at the time in education, there was a tremendous amount of Java applets for everything. There were games, there were physics games, there were calculus games. So it was very appealing to our customers in middle school to have access to those Java applets. And we started implementing a really cool embedded object technology directly inside of NoteTaker. Very few people knew about it. But we'd have a dynamic pull-down menu. And what it simply meant was, if you wanted to run the calculus widget inside of a NoteTaker page, you could run it. But you have to understand, at that time, you had to deal with the security. You had to create your own sandbox. And so we were good engineers. We built a very secure system to run those Java applets. Well, two things happened along the way. One, Steve completely blew up Java along the way and said, we don't want any software that has anything to do with Java.
it did get a bad rap there for a while.
It got a bad rap, but what was ironic was that Java was a truly was beautiful in terms of write once, run everywhere if you could get the runtime installed on your desktop.
Yeah, and it was the darling of the Unix system when it first came out.
We were all
over Java back in the Jaguar days.
That's right. Absolutely. So that was sort of a hiccup along the way. So we had to tell our customers, you know, we love this technology, but in order for us to, you know, play well within the Apple ecosystem, we're going to have to withdraw support for these Java plugins. So that was one example where and there was no replacement for that strategy. So again, this whole sort of plug in an object or component to give your application a new behavior, we lost that competitive advantage. And that was unfortunate. I think the second part for us, John, was just Apple really, I understand part of the rationale, really tightened up sort of the whole rule of engagement in terms of the sandboxing and the gatekeeping. And that added another layer of quality assurance we had to run our software through, and that was not trivial. So that cost us money and time. And at the same time, as the Apple Store became more and more, you know, it became very popular, it also started to dilute the market. And, you know, we could spend an entire show on how would you fix the Apple Store. And I'm sure your listeners who are users of the Apple Store probably know a lot more about this than I do or you do. I mean, it's just, again, it's one of those topics that doesn't seem to have an easy resolution. But from a developer standpoint, it comes down to discovery and it comes down to support. And, you know, I don't think this is, you know, probably the platform where you'd want to spend an hour talking about how to fix it. But from discovery system inside of the store.
Do you find that the yearly updates to OS X create stress in compliance?
Yeah, that's absolutely, because for users, they've got an investment in a platform, and it's not a trivial investment. They have an investment in their particular system, maintaining their particular system. And I really feel for users that have had to sort of march to this forced upgrade. I understand why Apple did it, but you know, I think it's sort of that it's the reality of being in the software business. You don't really get a choice. You either you know, adapt or you don't.
Yeah, so I've seen some suggestions that Apple should start upgrading the OS in a major way every 2 years with periodic security updates. What do you think?
I don't think there's a set schedule. I think it really comes down to, you know, security is in its own bucket. You know, everything should be predicated on security first. I think that to me is a high order bit. Everything should happen security first. But from just a pure business economics for developers, it's a big challenge to keep up. And it also, you have to make some tough decisions that you have forced obsolescence as a result. You can't have an infinite number of versions out there in the marketplace, because the reality is that Apple also fixes bugs. I mean, I won't, you know, go into that, but there's also a big challenge when you take on a new technology and you decide to adopt and support one of Apple's APIs, you're making a bet too that they'll continue to support that API.
Mm-hmm.
And that's just a business risk that you have to take. So an example might be that if you bet early on with iCloud, you might have been taking some risk, whereas maybe a better decision might have been to support Dropbox or Box or Google Drive, you know, some other synchronization method. Because, you know, these are big problems for platforms that developers would like to have solved for them, magically solved, which is, you know, sort of a very robust, trustworthy, secure way to synchronize user data across all.
There were some early problems with iCloud data, as I recall, and people were doing their own synchronization code.
That's right. And also, Apple itself has had a challenge because, think about it, they also have their own web apps, and they have their own desktop apps, and they have their own iOS apps. And I think a lot of users listening to this program might relate to just take the example of the contacts, or used to be called the address book. And contacts went through various data file format generations of supporting VCF, for virtual, you know, cards. And that format itself is sort of not owned by Apple. It's sort of an industry standard. Well, if you don't parse that data correctly and the application you're sourcing from doesn't generate a conforming version, you could end up with, quote, corrupted or bad data upstream in the cloud, and that just goes everywhere, right?
Speaking of corruption, how do you feel as a developer about HFS Plus? Is it doing everything for you that you'd like, or have you had any longings for a better file system?
Yeah, that would be better answered by real architects. But I do believe at the end of the day, I'll make this prediction though for you, okay? Which is sort of a sideline to answering your question. So I'm not the expert on this. So we really have to talk to my partner Mike about what would be the ideal, redundant store. But every computer scientist and anybody who deals in data store and file systems and architectures, I think what we will see very shortly, well, maybe not shortly, but I think will have to happen, will be we'll have to have a very robust, redundant data store that stores a lot more than what we're doing today. And what I mean by a lot more context. So in order to get a more personal computer, a more intelligent experience, user experience, we're going to have to store a lot more contextual data.
Metadata.
Yeah, a lot of metadata, a lot of behavioral data that some users will want to store. Others will say, hey, man, you are starting to encroach on my privacy of patterns.
Oh, yeah, the creepy factor.
But a good example would be that when you use voice to make a phone call from your car in hands-free mode, I might say, call John. And the system comes back and says, well, Scott, you have 6 Johns in your address book. Which John do you want me to call? And I'll say, call John at Mac Observer. And all of that activity data would get stored. And that's a lot of data, right? Because I'm beginning to store the time of day.
Yeah.
The time of day, was it a business call? Was it a friendly call? What was the location when you called? And as you get closer to really powerful predictive systems that can really help you out, you're going to store a lot more data. So I do think the long-winded answer to HFS is, yes, it will be replaced. What will it look like? I don't know. It'll be a multi-dimensional object store system that, has n number of, cells that are all three-dimensionalized and can store things in an interesting way. And you're going to need a lot of memory to do that, because people will expect a good system to be responsive. And a good system to be responsive is going to need a lot of memory, in my opinion.
And a lot of redundancy. And we're going to have to make RAID 5 just totally transparent. And we're starting to see glimmers of that.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And I was mentioning to someone the other day that one of the most impressive feats I've seen with Amazon's, using Alexa on an Echo device, that the response time is really, really good. Now, there's network latency, obviously, but the quality of the microphones and the engineering they spent in getting that data collection, your voice, and wrapping that up and transporting that and then converting that speech to text, it's fabulous. It's a really, really impressive system.
Cool. Well, you know what? We were going to talk about some other things that we chatted about, but we're out of time.
Oh, no.
but you know what? That's okay, because this was fascinating. You know, it's hearing about the challenges that developers face in 2016 is very important, and it's always very interesting. And hearing you talk about how you had to deal with these challenges as a developer is just awesome. So as we wrap up, tell the listeners how to contact you if they wish.
Well, I'm always reachable through email, which is always the quickest way to reach me. It's just scott@aquaminds.com. It's real simple. Cool. And I check my mail daily. I'm very good about it.
Okay. Well, I thank you very much for being on the show. This was very informative, my old friend. It was great to hear from you again. And listeners, thank you for joining us. I hope you had a good time. And we'll see you next time on the Mac Observer's background mode.